Welcome to the Mentors Project podcast, covering mentorship, books, and more. In this podcast, we interview the authors of a new series of books where we meet the men and women who mentored Western civilization. This is Dr. Roseanne Welch. For more information, visit mentorsproject.org. Our guest today is Peg Lamphere, author of Little by Little We Won, a novel based on the life of Angela Bombes. An Italian-Brazilian-American, she was a labor organizer whose life spanned from the time of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory Fire in 1912 to being a delegate in the 1968 Democratic National Convention. And all her life, she worked for the International Ladies Garment Workers Union for over 50 years. Welcome, Peg.
Thank you for having me, Roseanne.
We want to ask right up front, why should Angela matter to people today?
One, there aren't nearly enough histories of women. Two, there aren't nearly enough histories of labor organizers who've been demonized in America in the last few years. And three, what histories we do have of labor organizers are generally about Jewish American labor organizers, because they were America's, that was the racial minority group that was really interested in labor organizing in the teens, 20s, and 30s.
I had not heard that before, so now that makes me think, how did the Italians get involved?
Hardly at all. And that's one of the things that makes Angela really, really interesting. Italian Americans were notoriously difficult to unionize, and then they didn't particularly want to talk to the Jewish organizers who came to their door, because it was mostly Italian American women working in the needle trades in New York in this time period we're talking about. Those Italian American women's, their husbands and fathers didn't want them talking to Jewish guys who came to the door. Strangers. I don't know if there was a, there may or may not have been a religious issue there, but I suspect that varied from case to case, family to family.
Well, strange men coming to your door would not have been
approved. Strange men coming to your door. And that's one of the reasons Angela and her mom and her sister were successful, because they're really one of the first Italian-American women to be on-the-ground organizers. And they discovered quickly on that you could organize Italian-Americans if you just used the right people.
So does that mean they didn't have men, fathers, brothers in their life to stop them getting involved, or were they just more of an equal, balanced family?
Oh, the Bombes family is an interesting family. There's men there, but the men all seem kind of weak and ineffectual and sort of professional, sitting in the chair, moaning and bitching and complaining, but not really getting much done. Angela's mother was, her father died young. Angela's father was like chronically unemployed, and Angela's mother took care of the family and I think got some authority and power from being the breadwinner. Angela's husband herself was a kind of ineffectual guy, and then after 6 years that marriage was over, so she was an independent woman. Angela's sister married a union organizer, mm-hmm. who actually turned out to be the biggest pain in the butt of the whole family.
Oh, that's so crazy.
Yeah. Well, just because a guy's a labor organizer and a self-described progressive doesn't mean he's good on women's issues.
Certainly not back in the day.
Certainly not.
Hmm. Interesting. So was the mother also involved in the needle trade?
You know, she wasn't really. She did some, it sounds to me like she did some piecework in the house. And then she would on occasion have to go out and work, and then she'd come back. But the girls, the husband seems to have managed to hold a job until about the time the girls graduated from high school. And that was a big achievement that mom made sure they didn't drop out at the end of eighth grade. And then the girls went to work and supported the family, and then sometimes mom. But mom was really interested in going with the girls when after work they went knocking on doors organizing. Really, it's a story that shows up both in the few books that mention Angela and in Angela's family's history. Some of the young men who worked for the local crime boss roughed up Angela and some other ladies one night. And Mama was not having it, so Mama took her rolling pin, and this is like a parody. She took her rolling pin down to the local crime boss's office, which happened to be in the back of a bar. So one, she went into a bar, a lady,
right,
and then she went back to this room, and she barged in with her rolling pin, and she told this guy, who apparently she'd gone to grammar school with, "You don't treat ladies that way." Don't you ever do that again. Don't let me find out any of your boys did anything like that. And after that, it was hands off with that particular crime family and labor organizing in Italian Harlem.
That is hilarious.
Isn't
I have
that
to
fun?
Say, it almost makes me wish that there was paperwork and we could get a book on the mom who must have had a crazy life.
Well, you know what's really cool about the mom is this lady, her mom immigrated to Brazil with her daughter. So Angela's grandmother and mother, so mother was a child, grandmother was an adult woman, no man, left Italy, immigrated to Brazil. The two of them.
Hmm.
And that's Irish-American women immigrated alone. A lot of Jewish women immigrated alone. Italian-American women tended to come in families. And of course, we're talking about Brazil, but immigration is immigration.
Right.
So we're talking about a long line of women that defied expectations.
Fascinating.
I know.
So that covers a little bit of, but let's get a little maybe deeper into, certainly her mother was an influencer in childhood, but what else in her childhood influenced her wanting to be a labor organizer?
Oh. She was just a kid when the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire happened. And Italian Harlem, so not Little Italy, because that's actually on the other end of the Manhattan Island, Italian Harlem wasn't far from the Ash Building, which had burned. And that was really famous. But not only that, the guys that ran that building, they'd had several fires that had killed people before. So the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, while it's the most famous fire, wasn't the only industrial fire in New York. But it was the biggest. And then there was this, and this is the thing, everybody knows, 146 people died, and the fire was bad, and the stairwells were blocked, and the windows were nailed shut. Everybody knows that, and that's all true. But there was this massive funeral demonstration a few days later that no one ever talks about. It was this massive public demonstration of defiance against the New York officials who refused to do anything about the way these sweatshops were run. And the city poured out. And apparently this parade of people who lined up, you know, different organizations, all with their signs, and they marched all the way down Manhattan Island, and then they took the ferry across the way to the one cemetery that would take all these Jewish ladies that had been burned to death. It was this massive thing. And that had to have been a seminal experience. There was also, they took all the dead bodies, they took them down to, literally there was a pier called Misery Pier.
Which, oh, lovely. Yeah, make that up.
A warehouse. Yeah, it was a warehouse, and they put all the bodies in there, and then people lined up to walk through there looking for loved ones, but people also lined up just to walk through. So there was like a two-day, that was kind of a thing to do in New York. And I don't know if Angela saw the parade. I don't know if she went to Misery Lane. But those seemed like fun things to write, so I put her there. Because I was trying to tell the story of not just Angela, a woman labor organizer, but a story about labor organizing writ large. Because it's a story that needs to be told in an America that kind of increasingly thinks unions are bad and that we don't need them anymore.
I find that often an interesting topic because my grandmother was a member of the International Ladies' Garment Workers Union. And as my childhood, we never bought anything that didn't have a union label.
Right.
And that phrase still runs through my head. And it fascinates me when people don't think about that first or go into the rumors about what's wrong with unions when I've read what's right with them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of amazing that a woman was one of the ground, many women, I should say.
Many
in
women.
That way, which we don't know enough about.
Mm-mm.
Well, so beyond her mother then, what other relationships in her life really fueled her to move into this world?
She had, and this was notable, there were some other late Italian labor organizers, but they tended to work just with other Italians. Angela had no problem crossing what they thought of as racial lines by working with Jews. And she had a lot of Jewish friends in the kind of way that made her notable. And she was particularly good friends with Rose and Charles Zimmerman. He's commonly known as Sasha Zimmerman. And there, if you do labor history, you've heard of the Zimmermans. So she spent a fair bit of time with the Zimmermans. And she may even have stayed with them briefly when she left her husband. She also was mentored by David Dubinsky, who was a longtime president of the International Ladies Garment Workers Union. And the International Ladies Garment Workers Union was infamous for not allowing any female officers. And David Dubinsky was the one who she convinced you should have women in charge of stuff. And so during the Depression, he sent her to Baltimore to run the Southern Division.
Baltimore was, well, I guess that's true. Maryland was.
Well, Southern. Because the problem was that labor in the American South was done by African Americans, and nobody was organizing blacks. And that was one of the shocking and astounding things that Angela did in Baltimore. Baltimore is a very diverse town. She organized places with black workers, and that was like, oh! And both shocking because it was a white lady out talking to black people, and because there was a notion that black workers were almost as impossible to organize as Italians.
Yeah. So did she always work for the garment union, or did she work in other industries?
The notable thing about, and this is what everybody says, indeed, she started out her life as a socialist, an anarchist, and a communist. And she belonged to different little unions that no one's ever heard of that were based in one of those three political persuasions. But Angela didn't care about politics. What she cared about is who's getting the job done. So like the IGLWU was for a long time really only interested in organizing white males. So in the garment business, there was a two-tiered system. You had all the women who ran the machines, and they were essentially the peasantry of the needle trades, and then you had these male cutters. And the IGLW was really interested in organizing these male cutters, but not all the women who pushed fabric under a sewing machine. Huh. And so she didn't work with the IGLW at first because they weren't doing what she thought needed to be done. So she would go. So for a while, it looked like the anarchists had a group. Well, I'll work with them. And then the communists have a thing, so I'll work with them. She went with whoever was interested in working with the people that needed it the most. She's an immensely practical person.
So at what point and how was she involved in getting women represented by that union?
The International Ladies Garment Workers Union?
Yes.
She goes in and out of it. The Local 20 was the union office in Italian Harlem. And she's in and out of that office kind of depending on who's running it. Like maybe this year I'm working with them because there's a guy I can work with. But then next year they get a new guy in there and I don't like him. So then I'll go work with him with a different union. American Clothing Workers Amalgamated, she worked with a fair bit too. She's very practical. She wasn't at all loyal to any particular organization. She cared about women having fair wages and not dying on the job.
Gee, that's such a small thing to worry about.
Crazy woman.
So what would you say are her, besides getting Dubinsky to allow women into essentially the board of directors, what were the other achievements she could clock along her way?
She ran a bunch of strikes, some of them which were really important, that there's not much on. Like apparently she was really instrumental in the 1919 cloakmaker strike, but I couldn't find hardly anything on it. But people kept saying that was a big deal because she kind of single-handedly organized that. I think America was full of strikes that don't, there's not much information on it. That you get the sort of the really big ones, the 1909 rising of the 10,000, that kind of thing. Organizing black workers in Baltimore was a really big deal. Integrating that office, she hired a black driver. She wouldn't think as much. Well, of course you'd have a black driver. But it was a big deal. She hired this black guy to drive her, and then, because she never drove, New Yorker.
Yeah.
He would drive her around, but she would, if they were someplace where he couldn't go in and eat with her, she'd get the food to go, and they'd sit in the car and eat, and she'd sit in the front seat with him. And that was, that was shocking. It's an accumulation of a lot of little things and the kind of stuff that doesn't get you famous in America. She spends her whole life doing the right thing, working for the right thing, and really rolling a ball uphill, because organizing workers against the people who own the means of production, that is a thankless, dirty, terrible job, and you're going to lose 89% of the time.
True. But you have to keep going or you don't see the change at all.
Yeah, and this is a woman who never quit, never got tired, never got down. Her grandkids said, you know, they had nothing but great things to say about Nana and how funny she was and how she could hold her liquor and all of her friends that she had. She'd go into a bar and the whole bar would be like, Angela! And, you know, this was just one of those larger than life women who went through the world being the star of every room she was in. Like Hubert Humphrey, when she was in the hospital dying, Hubert Humphrey called her and he, Angela? Yes, who is this? This is Hubert Humphrey. No, it's not. And she hung up on him. And then he called back. He's like, Angela, it's really me. And she didn't think he'd do that, but she was a delegate for him a few times because he was really good with workers' rights.
And he ran for president four times?
A few times.
Yeah, a few times, exactly.
And he was kind of perennial in the 60s.
Yes, and he was vice president.
Uh-huh.
Yes, so at what point when she was dying, was he already a former vice president? Was he?
Well, she was at the 70, she was at the 68 convention. The one in Chicago.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, with the mess. And
the crazy, exactly.
Well, the great thing about that is she took her granddaughter, who I was in contact with. Two of her grandkids were really generous sharing information. And the granddaughter who went with Angela to the convention was emailing me and on the phone with me. So everything I know about Angela at that convention, where they stayed and what they went and what that was like and what they saw, I know from her.
Oh, beautiful. What an excellent thing for a historian to be able to contact.
I know, and because I generally work with people who are long dead, that was both unusual and kind of scary to be writing about somebody whose grandkids remembered her. I mean, it's an awesome responsibility to not screw up somebody's grandma, right?
True, but she sounds like the kind of woman whose life was not something you'd find scandal or bad things in anyway.
Well, she did. She was kind of scandalous because after 6 years of marriage, she left her husband and then he sued for divorce and he took the kids away from her on the principle that as a union organizer, she was ipso facto a bad person.
Wow.
And thus a bad mother. So he got custody of their sons. And so she was like, well, fine. And her mom was like, well, fine. So mom bought a house in Flushing, like three houses down from where the husband lived. And the kids just went back and forth between the two places. It was kind of like, well, you can take my kids away, but you can't take my kids away if I live in the neighborhood.
Exactly. How can you possibly do that?
So she moved across the river into Flushing so that they could do that. And then Mama would watch the boys, when Angela had to go somewhere or be somewhere. The divorce trial was kind of, you know, it was scandalous. Fiorella LaGuardia, the famous mayor of New York.
Italian mayor of New York.
Yes,
huge.
The little flower. He wanted to be her divorce lawyer, but then he couldn't, but he got a friend to do it. And then, according to Angela, he proposed to her, and she said, I'm done with husbands. And indeed, she had the love of her life was another labor organizer, a guy who organized in the theater businesses. They never married. They just lived together. And she was Angela and he was Louis. And sometimes he was in New York and sometimes he was in Baltimore. And
wow. Not something we think.
For a lady who died in 1975, that's all fairly unusual.
A bold move for a woman to make, expecting to be respected in her business by doing a thing that others thought was disrespectful.
Yeah. And pulled it off,
exactly.
Yeah.
I like her already.
I know. She's pretty neat.
Cool. Well, so tell me, in doing this, because these are novels, so you had the chance to fictionalize a little bit, what would you say is the coolest scene you got to write?
Not about cool, but the very first chapter, I sat down the very first day, and I wanted to write something that didn't. I started with the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire that day, what's happening. And I went from scene to scene, and Angela's not even in that chapter. But I wanted to establish right off, what are the stakes? We're not talking about organizing professors so they can have longer vacations. We're talking about life and death. And as much as people might know about the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, it was worse. And I had to delve into the sources and sort of get who was where when, and I had to calendar minute by minute how that went and where was the fire and et cetera, et cetera. And then I wrote actual people, like, these ladies died in the fire shaft. And so I used their names and imagined how that was for them. It was horrifying, and it took me longer to write that chapter than it usually does. So I'm a very fast writer. It took me a long time because I'd write 500 words, 600 words, and I'd have to stop because it just felt so awful. But it ended up, I was really proud of it when I was done because I think it was really powerful. And it did, I think it does what I wanted to do, which is establish the stakes.
And honor the women who died, who aren't always, don't see their names in history books.
Yeah, and it's stuff like, one of the girls, she's going out, and her sister says, wait a second, I'm going to go back and pee. And she says, I'll wait for you. Well, those girls didn't get out. Yeah. And there was a lady, a motherly lady, who was sending girls into the... These two elevator operators took a bunch of trips up and down to get girls out. And there was a woman who was herding girls in and never went herself. She stood there at the elevator shaft until the very end. And when the guy said, we can't come up anymore, she said, okay, take these girls.
Wow.
And she stayed there.
Wow. Almost a Titanic-y kind of
moment. Yeah, and we'll never know that woman's name. And that's the kind of stuff momish women, people do.
And need to be seen as heroes more often
really
in these
cool
kinds of works. Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that. Mm-hmm. Well, then, think about, what do you think in your own background made you the right person to tackle Angela's life?
In all honesty, the lovely gentleman who's established this whole project and this whole series, I met him and I really liked him, and we were having this very congenial talk one day, and I said, I think this is a fabulous idea what you're doing, and I love that you gave me an opportunity to write about this Civil War cavalry guy, but you know what I've noticed? You don't have a lot of women on your list. And he said, well, get me some names. And I thought, really? Okay. And I picked her, again, because she's a union organizer, and I think it's important that we tell the other side of the story, that if it weren't for unions, we wouldn't have a minimum wage, we wouldn't have an 8-hour day, we wouldn't have any OSHA, any safety standards, we wouldn't have any of that stuff, because we're post that stuff, so now we think we don't need that, but it's ridiculous. If we took away all those unions, we'd go back to that, because humans are cheap.
Yeah.
And the owners of the means of the production don't generally care about workers because there's lots of them.
There's always more where you came from is what they
used
to say.
And that's not okay in a democracy. So workers' rights are really important to the democratic experiment.
I agree. I agree with that 100%.
And clearly you can tell from my passion, I take it really seriously. So I wanted to write her, and I was extremely pleased to be allowed to write her.
So it sounds to me like you're sort of walking around what was the theme or the themes that you found in her life. So obviously a love of democracy and wanting that equality that we talk about all the time. But kind of what themes do you think were running through her life that drove her?
You're like the English teacher I hated in high school. I hate the theme questions. What are the three themes of Kitcher and the Brown? Well, I don't know. It was a good story. Mm-hmm. Themes. You're right. Resistance to expectations. Fighting for the people who cannot fight for themselves. Fighting for the powerless. Being the genuine version of you instead of the version of you that people want you to be. What I've learned studying these wonderful, great people and all the writing I've done, is that's the only way to be great, is to figure out what the most genuine version of you is and then fully be that. Because everybody, the people who buy beige stucco houses and the same car as the neighbors and do the same stuff and meet all the expectations, I'm not saying those people make the world a worse place, but they don't make the world a better place.
And they don't change it. They don't help change forward. Fascinating. I agree. I think that's what sounds so interesting to me about Angela. And the other women, the many women, as you mentioned, whose names we'll never know, who contributed to these movements.
Mm-hmm.
How cool. Well, then, We mentioned a little bit about her mother and Dubinsky. Were there any other people that qualified as mentors in her life? Or who did she mentor in her life?
Well, she was a really powerful mentor to her, to other union organizers, other young women organizers. She was also a really powerful mentor to her kids and her grandkids. And she's got a mass of grandkids, not a mass, but she's got some, and they're all, like, one of the grandkids is a jazz musician and lives out in Palm Springs. And, you know, it's not a nice, safe, middle-class thing that he's doing. And one of Angela's kids made a lot of money. But he's a jazz musician. And the, one of the granddaughters runs a charity that does a bunch of stuff. But she created this sort of tradition of service. Even her kids, the one son that made a ton of money, did it because he was trying to fix a problem people had. He created an insurance company for workers. The union insurance didn't cover eye care. So he created an insurance company that would cover eye care. But then that was immensely successful, and then he sold it for a lot of money. But it was because he thought workers should be able to have eye exams covered in their health insurance. So she raised people who cared about social justice issues.
That itself is an achievement.
Yeah, it really is.
So I have to ask, because I always do, who are your mentors?
I think, like a lot of women my age, I'm mentored by a sisterhood of other women of a certain age. I have all sorts of female friends that mentor me, whether they mean to or not, in 100 different ways for 100 different things. I have a friend who's particularly good at, settle down, Peg, this isn't a big deal, let's just be cool. I have a friend who's really good at issues of spirituality. I have a friend who's a really good writer. I don't have that one sort of, oh, there was that professor in college and she or he recognized my greatness. You know, and the really prosaic answer, my mom, you know, who taught me, while not saying it, but by doing it, she taught me to work hard. Don't sit down any more than you have to. Don't sleep too much because people die in their beds. Keep moving. Keep doing stuff. Work hard. Be nice. Tell the truth.
Sounds like the same thing Angela taught her grandchildren.
Yeah, probably.
I love that.
Yeah.
Well, then thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. That was very pleasant.
Thanks for listening to the Mentors Podcast, sponsored by the Barbera Foundation, whose mission is to promote positive change by inspiring others to engage in their community. Your host has been Dr. Roseanne Welch. Our music was composed by Patrick Abate, technical direction by Douglas E. Welch, and Kathleen Childress designed our website. For more information and to read more about the great mentors in history, visit mentorsproject.org and join us for our next conversation.